You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Long before President Kennedy, John Quincy Adams suggested that the nation observe the heavens, observe space with a series of observatories. Long before Eisenhower, he proposed a national road and massive infrastructure, roads and canals to connect the country. And long before any modern president, and like Washington before him, John Quincy Adams proposed a national university that would celebrate, honor, and improve the great minds of America. Those things wouldn't entirely come to fruition for him. But in terms of presidential vision, he probably ranks as high as any president.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're going to talk about him a bit with Bob Crawford. I'm really excited to have Bob on. He is the co-host of the Road to Now podcast about history and today, and he co-hosts that with Ben Sawyer, and also he's the bassist for the band, the Avett Brothers. And he does a whole podcast series called Founding Son, which you can get on iTunes and all those good Apple podcasts, all those good places. Okay, so really excited to talk to Bob. Now, we do get into a lot of being that Bob is an old college friend. We get into a little nostalgia and some talking about current politics and stuff. So if you want to get right to John Quincy Adams, I'd say, go about minute 23 or so of this podcast. You'll get that. Otherwise, listen to the whole thing. Happy to have you. I am here with Bob Crawford. We were co-alumni of Stockton State College in the woods of South Jersey.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
Boy, it's insane, isn't it? I what was I thinking the other day? I saw something about 1994, something that happened in 1994, and I realized that I've known Bruce Carlson since before that.
Right. WLFR, Lake Fred Radio, in Pomona.
91 is probably when I met you. And to think, so first of all, Bruce, thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, great to have you on.
Always honored when you come on the Road to Now. Really enjoy talking with you because we go so far back.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe it almost. And I was just down in the Atlantic City area. It always brings up nostalgia. One of the things to say about where Bob and I went to college is that not only is it a good school, decent, like liberal arts state school type thing, but it's also big environmental, big. I went for literature and history, and I loved it. But it's also the great part about it is in the middle of the woods in the Pine Barrens, and you can walk around, and it's a beautiful thing. You get an education from the school, and you get an education from the forest around the school, especially for a northern New Jersey guy like me, where, I really learned a lot down there. But
yeah, and Bruce, I have to wonder if it is at all like it was when we were there. I have no idea.
I didn't get a chance to visit, as you can imagine. Traveling with one spouse, like it's not very exciting to say, let's go visit my old campus.
It is not for them. No, it is not.
Atlantic City itself, I find immensely interesting. The boardwalk, always love it. We both like history, and I just think, it's a place to go on vacation where there's also ghosts of old time and everything from, I'm like, this is the pizzeria where the model Gigi had her family had the pizzeria, too. Here's an old bank building from the 1920s. This building was in Boardwalk Empire. It was featured. It was reconstructed and featured in Boardwalk Empire as where the Nucky Thompson was running everything from. And here's the Casino Control Commission. And here's the old Irish pub. Do you remember the Irish pub?
Yeah. Oh, I remember the Irish pub. It's in fragments, but I do remember it.
Do we remember it better than the Stockton Library or as well as the Stockton Library?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I definitely remember the Irish pub better than the Stockton Library. And I remember the Stockton pub better than the Stockton
Library. The Stockton pub, yeah, this little the Ratskeller. Yeah, that was a great place to you know, to catch a few after our studies.
And Bruce, I remember, was it Upper G Wing where WLFR was and where
Stockton Save Action was? Volunteers for the Environment. Yeah, you look at that school, it's a tiny school. Maybe it was a couple thousand students, but maybe 4,000 students, but a lot of influence on environmental policy in the U.S. at that time. A very active group, and the radio station, which was really cool. Unfortunately, I don't believe it's this way anymore. It's much more part of the curriculum now, but it was not any part of the curriculum. Do whatever show
it was always on the verge of being shut down.
This is true.
Constantly is true. On the verge of being shut down by because of what someone played.
Right.
At midnight on a Friday or Saturday night.
And, I ran the station for 6 months, and I am the only general manager of that station to give myself a time off the air as a penalty because they had some kids from the high school on. They said some bad words, and I was like, well, I got to abide by the policy. And, you know, I realized I'm better at the content than the administration end of things.
Well, I got to say, I was appointed general manager we're going to appoint someone or we're going to shut it down. And I was appointed for 3 days and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I was not at that point in my life. I did not have the skills to do. That was quite a job. Lori McCardle was the
She was great.
She was the best.
Everybody was. Oh, we had Adam Pock, the sheriff, and now he's been on Big Brother. He was Brother in 2011. Yes. He got to the number. I recently watched it. He got to the number three spot. He was pretty good. He was pretty crafty, but he couldn't beat the politics there. So he was the sheriff. I was. I did my big hunk of Elvis, and I was called the Colonel at times. And so I go to Hoboken and there's Adam Pock on a bus and I'm just like, sheriff. And he's like, Colonel, sheriff, Colonel. And the people on this bus are like, the hell is up with these guys? You know? Oh man. So good times. Good times. I also remember Bill Gross. I don't know if he's.
Oh yes, I do. Yeah.
I went on his show. And so back in that day, this is like file it under WLFR stories. So it might be interesting to the listener that, you know, old college radio. So we had these records that would be the interview. So like, you know, it wasn't like you had all this digital stuff where you could relay an interview by a famous person. They would send a vinyl record with the person's answers. And then you put the needle down at the right time as you're asking the question on the mic. And so this was Bernie Taupin, who was Elton John's writer. And so Bill Gross would be like, how do you write your songs? Oh, my songs come from this inspiration and that. How do you get along with Elton? Oh, Elton and I really get along famously or whatever. And then Bill Gross would be like, blah, 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 blah. Oh, talking about that song. Well, and he would just throw in this stuff. And it's the kind of stuff that I think in a modern college, they would just kick you off the air. But there you could pretty much do within reason any kind of show you wanted.
It was the heyday of college radio. And it was the heyday of Left of the Dial.
Yeah. And it set us up well. It is still on. It's a little more commercial now, but it is still college run, still student run. Let's put it that way, with faculty help. And it's gives people an education. You know, we got an education doing it. I love college radio. I think for podcasters, obviously for me, as soon as I saw this podcasting thing, I'm like, oh my God, I got to jump on this. It gave me an education in something that could only be an outlet for. in podcasting. I tried doing a little country station out in West Jersey, and it was just, you know, didn't pay enough. And you guys started your podcast with Ben Sawyer, who everybody likes on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, one of our favorite guests, like speaks Russian and is brilliant.
He is brilliant, for sure.
I can't have him on too. I don't know how you handle it. He makes me look stupid.
Bro, I know. But, you know, we have, you know, I think that Ben and I have different, because we have different skill sets, it works. But Ben is so organized, and
yeah,
he can take a topic and he can give you this 30,000 foot view of a question or a topic, mm-hmm, and that I never even saw. Like when I was doing my research, I didn't even see the question he sees. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I like the episodes. I like all the episodes on Road to Now. I do. It does. It's like everything else. I got to catch up, and people do that with my show. But I'm always catching up. But I love the ones where it's you and Ben talking, or sometimes with you and one of the Avid brothers. But I generally like when it's you and Ben talking. And there was one, we had this discussion on Marxism that I thought was great, and you had a different perspective, and he was right, explaining his, and
yeah,
and you got a good, neither is a committed Marxist from what I could hear. You're just talking about it. Yeah. I don't know if anyone, if you're listening to this show and you're not signed up to Road to Now, I mean, obviously go do that. You can do it on your phone these
Please
days.
Do that. Please do that. Yeah. Ben will say, you know, why don't we do a you and I episode this week? And I'm like, oh God, what are we going to talk about? You know, cause having a guest can just make it so much easier because you have a direction, you know, you know the direction you're going in. And sometimes it can be a little haphazard to do a show, not on the fly, but you know, okay, let's, you and I do this, and we'll talk about X, Y, and Z. And anyway, but people love, and I'm always skeptical, but then people say, man, we love the shows where it's you and Ben talking. And so, you know, like I say, Ben, he sees things that I can't see. And I guess that's why we're a good team.
What's a recent show that you really would highlight or was really exciting for you?
Yeah, we just did a show that we released this week about the Florida education standards.
Mm-hmm.
And we had historian Andrew Polk and Anna Goni Lesson, who is a reporter for the USA Today, talking about what is happening with education standards, specifically in Florida. So Ms. Lesson is an incredible reporter for the USA Today, and she's been covering all of these, be it the AP Psychology, be it the AP African American Studies, or book banning, you know, all this stuff that is, mm-hmm, happening in Florida. She's covering that beat. So she gave us a really good on the ground perspective. And then Andrew Polk, who's a colleague of Ben's at Middle Tennessee State University, gave us the perspective of how do you develop educational standards at the state level for public schools, and what all this may mean for learning history, for kids learning history in the years to come. So really one of my favorite episodes. It's always great to get a couple different perspectives in one episode, and I think we achieved that.
That's great. Well, check it out, everybody. Check it out, because that's a live issue. I haven't covered it enough, the debates on education, Ron DeSantis and Trump, but these days more Ron DeSantis moves so quickly with issues in the way that Trump used to, that it's hard to cover everything with his history.
Yeah. I think Glenn Youngkin, I think he's the guy who made this the Republican issue, because that's what he ran on in his gubernatorial race against Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah.
Here, as we were in the pandemic, it was an off-year gubernatorial election in what is now largely believed to be blue Virginia.
Right.
And Youngkin uses the parents' rights and education as his main issue. And it's, we're coming out of this is rooted in the mask mandates and closing down the schools. That's where I think the genesis of this issue is, and it's just, it's, it was kind of it's the honey hole for the GOP, and so they've expanded it.
It's funny, yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I mean, to get in terms of political strategy, I am aghast they are not running Glenn Youngkin.
Oh, sure, or Brian Kemp.
He has the formula. Brian Kemp might be too much of a rhino in those circles for him to get Republican support. Oh, the Democrats in Georgia would probably vote for him, as they did when he ran.
He's very popular, yeah. Right.
But I think that Youngkin in particular has the formula. He's got the snakebite antidote and that is exactly what you said. In other words, sure, we take a look at a state and it looks blue, but within there, there's a lot of shallow support. So if I just come up with a very nice kind of, and I don't go full like angry, you know, that's the Reagan lesson. Anytime when you're angry, you could still win elections, but you're winning by 50.5%. When right. when you're optimistic, you're winning elections. And I don't think that playbook's available. I'm just surprised that maybe he's a VP candidate. The Republican program in a fleece jacket is
yes.
deadly politically. Deadly. Now that sounds biased. And it's a little biased, but it's I'm really speaking in political terms. That's a very strong candidate. I'm surprised they're not using him more. DeSantis, to me, quickly, I'm just going to say it. He's the Dukakis of the Republicans so far. He does not have it. He does not look good on video. He has a couple of policies that'll, you know, and his wife, they bring Casey DeSantis out there, of course, but that's not going to bring you through, you know, you got some political issues that are good weapons, but, and Dukakis had it in 88 on Reagan incompetence, and so many people have been indicted, but you don't have that retail politics.
No, he does not have, he is not the, he doesn't have the skills. I just love the clip in Iowa of him with the little girl with the snow cone.
Right.
Or, you know, and he's like, hey, is that a slushie? And she's like, hey, he's like, a lot of sugar in that. You know, the guy just, he just doesn't have the retail politics.
Well, I think I'll put my political prognosticator hat on right now. If nothing changes, and if he doesn't change up things, you get to Iowa, and Iowa is a great decision maker. I believe, woe to the Democrats for abandoning Iowa. It has serves an important role. I mean, I know they still have a caucus in Iowa, but Democrats should have honored that state's place being just first. Maybe it's even if it's 3 hours first, just make it. But in any case, Republicans still have it first. Caucus is different from primary. So in a caucus, if people start running scared, they physically leave the group in whatever high school in Iowa they're in and join the other. So I think if DeSantis keeps running, you're running this possibility of the DeSantis voters running scared for someone like a Christie or some other force.
Well, yeah, I think Tim Scott in Iowa, I would watch him.
Tim Scott definitely could work. Iowa's good at picking. You don't have to have a super amount of money. You don't have to have a big name. You can be a quirky kind of third candidate and Iowans will bring you up. Lately, their influence hasn't been as strong as it used to be. And that's my counter to, I realize why Democrats moved it. But my counter would be that it's not like they rule everything. It's just a little introduction to the country. Here's what Iowa thinks. We're the wine tasters.
I could see Trump losing Iowa and losing New Hampshire, but still easily capturing the nomination like Biden did.
Yeah, you can do that now.
Yeah,
you can do that now. You don't need to win Iowa and New Hampshire anymore. It kind of starts in 92. So Clinton, first of all, Iowa just was a non-contest in 92. It was written off by everyone because Harkin was running. Mm-hmm. And Harkin's was very popular in Iowa. And then in New Hampshire, Tsongas is running. So even though Clinton loses, he's able to say, come back, kid.
I'm the comeback kid. Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. But I am surprised not to see a Youngkin. I think, you know, Youngkin's victory, first of all, some of it's just this a very normal reaction in Virginia. Virginia's off year, so is New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Murphy had a tough race in New Jersey. Usually it goes somewhat opposite trend. It doesn't mean from the presidential the year before in these.
Well, this is how Christie gets in, right?
Christie got in 2010. So yes, right after Obama.
And Scott Brown wins the Senate seat.
You have these reaction elections that are often going to be, you could take New Jersey all the way back. You have Florio after Reagan. It's actually Keene, but Florio runs really close. And then Florio after Bush wins in 1988, Florio, the Democrat, wins in New Jersey. Then after Clinton wins, Whitman wins, the Republican wins in New Jersey. Then after Bush wins, McGreevy wins, the Democrat wins in New Jersey. So New Jersey has this real off and on. Another part of it is this whole, like, what is blue and what is red? Is something a blue county? Is it a set of issues on parchment that they all agree to? No, it's a feeling. It's a feeling. About candidates. It's a, don't, you know, I want to be independent. I'm afraid of this. I want more of this. I want more of that. You know, all of that. That North Virginia is just like Arlington and a couple of counties. I mean, it can't totally carry. But well, we went on a tangent.
We're real quick, Bruce. let's button this section up of the conversation with a reminiscence. We started with a Jersey reminiscence, a Stockton reminiscence. Let's go back.
Okay.
Was Florio Whitman in the early 90s, right?
Yeah, in 93.
Okay, so my introduction to politics was pulling a flyer, you know, to working in politics. Like the only time I ever worked in politics, I pulled a flyer off of one of the billboards at Stockton, and it was $75 to work, get out the vote for Florio. Yeah. And it was in his headquarters at the precinct or whatever. The headquarters I worked in was in Pleasantville, in down on Main Street. And I had a 72 Chevy Impala. So I'm going there to make $75 that I can spend at Louis or the, you know, Stockton Pub.
Oh, later. Good old Louis. Good old Louis.
But I have a 72 Chevy Impala, which could fit easily 8 people, if not 10. And so they say, you're driving, you'll get an extra $50 to drive. And we go through these neighborhoods of Northfield, knocking on doors on election day all day long. And then we go to the campaign headquarters at night and we see our candidate lose. And it was just a tempting, I'm in the communications, I'm going radio is my direction here. Communications, right? Working communications in a campaign. And so anyway, that was a moment of a time for choosing, but I was so tempted after that experience to work on campaigns.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, even with everything going on, the anger and in politics today, I mean, it's still exciting to work on campaigns. There was a guy, I mean, former boxer, South Jersey, which is in New Jersey, you know, it's rare for a governor to come from South Jersey.
Especially a Democrat.
Especially Democrat, because it's not where the population is. But he came from the Camden area and, you know, you talk about communications, just a poor communicator. And that's really what it was. His program really wasn't bad, but it came out raising taxes. And we had one of the kind of first of these sort of pre-Perot campaigns. It was Hands Across New Jersey, where it was an anti-tax raising group that got a lot of attention. We're not really necessarily associated with either party, but just against the tax increase. And it really started some of those movements that you saw with Perot. So we saw some of that in New Jersey. I'll find a way to segue this into John Quincy Adams. So a scattered political environment where there's people of all sorts of different parties and different feelings. And you recently concluded a podcast series, which I hope if everyone hasn't listened, they will listen, called Founding Son, about John Quincy Adams.
Well, Bruce, we could also say that Hands Across New Jersey was a populist movement, and that was that was just a copy of or a reflection of these populist waves that our country has experienced. And in 1824, when Adams wins the presidency, he is up against a populist wave that will ultimately make him a failed one-term president. Why did I make Founding Son John Quincy's America? I made it because I am just intrigued by mid-19th century American politics. Mm-hmm. I think the period between the Revolution and the Civil War, specifically the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, are just a time in America that we don't talk about enough. And it's a time where, the Civil War didn't just fall upon us. It didn't right. just happen. It was the result of decades and decades of strife and arguing and debating and band-aids on the slave issue. It was the slave issue coming to the fore that it was our original sin when the Constitution's drafted, and it's something that we just couldn't reconcile. And it ultimately like all issues in relationships that are just, kept under the surface, at some point they boil over. And so Adams here, he's the son of John Adams, founding father, second president of the United States. And he becomes the sixth president of the United States himself at the end of a controversial election that was ultimately decided in the House of Representatives. So here he is, a minority president from day one.
The way it's decided, of course, if there's not a majority in the Electoral College, it goes to the House of Representatives to pick the president.
So the way the Constitution's written, or the way the amendment's written, I guess, is that the top three vote getters mm-hmm. go to the election in the House. In the House, each state delegation gets one vote.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
So this is what the Trump team wanted to do in 2020. They wanted to on January 6th, they wanted the certification to not happen. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't happen on January 6th and there's no resolution, you got to go to the House. If each state delegation had one vote in January, they would have tilted towards Trump because more Republicans had the majority in delegations than Democrats. So what happens in 1824 is Henry Clay is the fourth highest vote getter. He's out of the running for the vote that's going to take place in the House of Representatives. So he becomes president maker. He is the guy who can use his support to sway in the direction of really the two top candidates, John Quincy Adams, the establishment, the Boston Brahmin, if you will, the elitist, or the populist war hero, Andrew Jackson.
Or to use Henry Clay's description, the backwoods Napoleon. I mean, so he's a hero, definitely of the New Orleans battle. There's some controversy with him over his actions in Florida, where he, you know, arrested British citizens and took Spanish forts, kind of had a little MacArthur. Yeah, Monroe is looking to possibly even censure him for those actions.
Right. But for John Quincy Adams, who stands up for who was in the, he's the, of course, the Secretary of State in the Monroe administration. And when all this is going on, Clay and John C. Calhoun, who was Monroe's cabinet war secretary.
I think so.
Clay and Calhoun want to censure Jackson, and it's Adams who stands up for him. And it's really ironic that come 1824, it's between Adams and Jackson, and Clay, who hates Jackson with a passion and agrees with Adams' policies. Clay wanted something that was known as the American system, which, to put it in the parlance of our times, infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
And Adams believed in that, the federal government funding infrastructure projects around the country that will bring the country together and promote trade and commerce amongst the states. So, of course, Clay is going to support Jackson, right? Of course, he will lobby for Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. Plus, politically, I mean, someone like Clay, who made his bread and butter in politics in the a certain way, the congressional way, doesn't want some upstart coming.
He was Speaker of the House prior to this.
Right. He was a regular politician, a good one. Of course, Adams appoints Clay as Secretary of State. And now
was there a quid pro quo, Bruce Carlson? Was this a corrupt bargain?
You know, I'd take the word corrupt out of it, and I'd say it's certainly a bargain. I mean, there's just no way around it. A deal like that doesn't happen even in modern times. You know, maybe we're looking at it with our modern hindsight, but he's certainly allied himself with the Adams administration. I mean, I think, of course, the thing to think about Secretary of State is, what is it at that time? And it's, you don't get the presidency from the vice presidency. You get the presidency from the Secretary of State position. That had been Madison, that had been Monroe, now Quincy Adams.
Jefferson at one point.
Jefferson. And then so if you get that spot, you're going to be president soon. It gives him the executive experience that Clay wants. So you take the word corrupt out of it, which turns a normal Washington arrangement, which I'm sure Jackson and allies were doing plenty of that out there, into something that's a conspiracy theory so often in our politics then and now.
So immediately after Adams wins the vote in the House, Jacksonian, or at this point, not yet, we're not yet in the Jackson, we're on the edge of the Jacksonian period here. But the Jackson newspapers, because would you agree with this, Bruce? At that point, every newspaper was partisan.
Yeah, you had, you could be moderate partisan. You had certain Whig papers, they weren't Whigs yet. You had certain papers in Washington that might be a little more, some people would go very heavy than others, but every paper, the only way to get a paper started at the time is subscriptions and also to be sponsored by a party and the people running the papers, you know, your Thurlow Weeds and Horace Greeley's are partisans themselves.
Right. So these immediately, you know, Adams is president. He's, you know, about to be president. He nominates Clay as Secretary of State. And these papers favoring Jackson say this is a corrupt bargain, that it is a stolen election. Here, 200 years ago, 1824, 200 years ago, it's a stolen election. And the campaign for 1828 begins before Adams even takes the oath.
And that's a little new.
Yeah. And so Jackson's supporters in the House, and even, you know, a lot of Adams support, like, nobody supported Adams. Adams' own party didn't support him. You know, Adams gave in his first annual address to Congress, he says, he gives this statement. And again, it was written at the time. It wasn't a speech like we think of the State of the Union. It wasn't like that. And he says that he's laying out this program for to expand the federal government and to support infrastructure projects in the state, you know, by taxpayer money. He's promoting a naval academy. He's mm-hmm. promoting the building of telescopes for scientific research, what he called lighthouses in the sky. He says, hey, they're doing it in Europe. Are we going to be palsied by the will of our constituents and not do it here? And so what he's saying, and
that old winning American argument, they're doing it in Europe.
Right. And in the parlance of our times, once again, it's basically said, are we going to, you know, let a basket of deplorables who don't want to pay taxes tell us what we need to do, because we're the smartest people in the country. You know, that's what it sounded like. And knowing Adams, that's what he meant. And Ron DeSantis with the, hey, kid, there's a lot of sugar in that, you know, slushy. It's like it was kind of that he didn't have at this point in his life and career, Adams didn't have that human common touch. Jackson did. And people looked at Jackson and they said, you know, although Jackson was very wealthy, but they still said, hey, this guy's from the South, but he's from North Carolina, and he makes his wealth in Nashville, Tennessee. And he's a man of the West. He's a man, you know, the country was moving West. It was, and these, the new voters that were gaining the suffrage at the time, they were Westerners and Southerners, and they looked at Jackson and said, he's like me. He pulled himself up from his bootstraps. He wasn't this rich kid from Boston, this elitist. And Adams was just doomed. He was doomed like Jimmy Carter was doomed. I mean, he was just doomed from the start. And he didn't do himself any favors.
Right. He didn't, and he didn't have a constituency. There was and it was a permanent campaign, which really wasn't part of the equation in the past. Well, I suppose you could say, and during the Washington administration, you start a bit of that with Jefferson and Madison building their opposition. You have this kind of, you're just coming in with permanent opposition. I'm about to do Carter 1977. I can plug upcoming.
Please.
Coming out in September. And one of the points we make is when he looked at that dome, the Capitol dome, most of those people, Democrat or Republican, didn't want him in that chair. They had wanted Humphrey or Scoop Jackson or Brown or somebody else. He just happened to win on most of the primaries.
And largely, Carter, like Adams, like John Quincy Adams before him, and like John Adams, didn't want to play politics. Like John Quincy Adams wouldn't hand out the patronage. He's like, no, if a supporter of Jackson is in this job, and this happened with, I think, maybe the collector of, you know, what was that position that was very,
Port collector in New York would be the big one.
Port collector. Yeah. And he's like, well, you know, the guy's done he supports Jackson, but he's doing a good job. I have no reason to replace him. And because Adams wouldn't play that game, Philip Hone, who at one point was the mayor of New York, would say Adams's refusal to play party politics has lost him the support of all the parties. Yeah. You know, he just wouldn't, he just refused to do it because he thought that playing politics was beneath the office. And really, playing politics today is how you obtain the office and how you maintain the office.
And it's a skill. It's very complex, all of these relationships. And also, who moved from the legislative into the executive? Your best ally in the legislative, Henry Clay, who could get things done. Now he's sitting there in an administration that's not working. Adams also proposes a lot of things. And this is now, we're too early in American history, probably, for this to be seen as a bad. But now we know, and again, the Carter example, like a lot of goals early on in administration, that's really tough.
Yeah, Carter, another similarity to, and I did some writing. I'd hoped to write an op-ed comparing Carter and Adams. So I've done mm-hmm. thinking about this. I wrote it, it's just not very good, but they both worked so hard, right? Like Carter and Adams were both hands-on. They were both very hands-on, and they both would spend hours and hours working on policy, and they felt like they were the most qualified people in the room at all times. And part of being a president is delegating that. And probably Reagan did that much better than Carter, ultimately.
Well, certainly delegated better, yeah. I mean, Carter would read the defense appropriations. Now, I think it led to some good things. He had, you know, he would sit there and read the detail and then realize that, you know, we have to change our conventional strategy.
Yes, yes.
And it really moved working with Harold Brown, and he changed American defense. And I imagine Adams doing things like that. I mean, suggesting a national observatory. The National University is really Washington's kind of dying wish. And he even bought land for it. It's now, there is a George Washington University, but it's not public. You never had that American, true American university, possibly because the conspiratorial forces we talked about earlier.
Yeah. For sure. And you can look back on Adams, what he proposed, and then some of the things that we have, like a Naval Academy and like government funded infrastructure, which he was completely ahead of his time, but he wasn't the best messenger for that. And the times weren't ready for that.
And so John Quincy Adams, his presidency, you know, if that's all he had, there might be very, you're going to talk about any president at some point, but there might be very little reason to discuss this one
term. He would be like Buchanan, or he'd be like Harding, or he'd be, well, he wasn't as controversial as Harding was, but, you know, or as corrupt, but, or allegedly, or in reality. but yeah. And there's a lot of people lose when people learn about presidents, they lose a lot of them, right? Like they can't remember a Benjamin Harrison from a William Henry Harrison, from a Chester A. Arthur to a Grover Cleveland to a, you know, he would be one of these like lost. And I that's why I made this, because I feel like he's been lost. Mm-hmm. But like Jimmy Carter, again, Carter has one term, but we remember him fondly, and because of his post-presidency, right? Working for world peace and working with Habitat for Humanity and negotiating, overseeing elections in fledgling democracies. He has become, Carter won the Nobel, right? He won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's a beloved American president by many, even though he was a one-term president and his presidency could be looked at as not being successful. Adams was a failed one-term president, but what Adams does after he leaves office is he goes into the House of Representatives, and no other former president does that. But many presidents were in the House before they were president.
Right.
But none go into the House post-presidency. Now, there is Andrew Johnson, after he was impeached and president. He goes into the Senate, but it's for 5 months and he dies, right? So he doesn't really get to because he was a senator prior to being vice president for Abraham Lincoln, and then he's president, and then he, but Adams, he serves for 17 years in the House of Representatives. And while he's there, 17 years in the House of Representatives, and it's in the House that Adams does something at the time that is no one wants to have happen. He brings the issue of slavery, which is this blistering wound calloused under the skin of the Constitution. And he basically, let's try a different metaphor. Let's call it a boil, right? And Adams comes into the House and he lances the boil of slavery to where it becomes the issue that they are dealing with. Every issue that arises between 1830 and when he dies in 1848, which in itself is historic, but be it nullification, be it the issue over the bank, be it Texas, the annexation of Texas, every issue that comes up at the bottom of it, below the surface, it's slavery. There's a tension over the slave issue. Adams, and we can talk about how he did this, but he is the guy who brings it out in the open and says, we got to talk about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, because the Congress had a gag rule.
And the gag rule was, which was passed in May of 1836, is essentially an anti-John Quincy Adams rule. And I don't know if you can imagine these days a legislator being gagged.
You know, just have an issue that's so far, we just cannot talk about it. But
and that is happening today, right? It happened in Tennessee. It happened in Montana recently. But so how did the gag rule come about? Okay, so when Adams enters the House in 1831, and at the time you have this abolitionist movement. And the abolitionist movement was the anti-slavery movement. And it had gone through some changes over the years. And the new form of it, they were beginning to come up with this idea like, hey, we can't end slavery in the South, but maybe we can end slavery in the District of Columbia, and maybe we can end it in the territories, okay? Because the states have their states' rights, and the Constitution protects states' rights to property. But the Congress has control over what happens in Washington, D.C. There's a sitting committee in the House, the Committee on Washington, D.C. I think there's one in the Senate as well. And then there's the territories. So let's send petitions to Congress, because the First Amendment enshrines a citizen's right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And Bruce, you probably know this, but in the early 19th century, at the beginning of every session of Congress, for 2 weeks, 1 hour a day, congressmen from every state could present petitions and read them on the House floor. That was how people petitioned their government. Mm-hmm. And so your congressman from New Jersey, maybe his last name was Frelinghausen. I don't know, right?
Wouldn't shock, right?
Wouldn't shock, right?
Now.
He would say, I have a petition, Bruce Carlson from whatever county he lives in these days. And he wants, potholes in his, he wants the government to fix the potholes. I don't know. Whatever it was, that was how you let the government know that you wanted change and how you asked for new laws as a citizen.
And they read it into the record.
And they read into, and maybe they'll say, this goes to the committee on such and such. Mm-hmm. This will send this to the committee on this and that, right? Well, abolitionists began to send these petitions to the Congress for the ending of slavery in the District of Columbia. And Adams, on the first day he's in the House, he reads 15 of them. And he says, you know, I don't agree with what they're asking here. I don't know that we can really do this constitutionally, but this is what these citizens, they are praying. These 15 ladies from this town in Massachusetts, or these Quakers in Pennsylvania, they're praying for an end to slavery, the slave trade in the District of Columbia. And no one pays too much attention to it. But what happens over the next 5 years is these things begin to come in by the wagon load, to where there's thousands and thousands coming in a month, these petitions against slavery. And at one point, the book, William Levitt, the abolitionist William Levitt, he writes that he was walking down the hallways of Congress and they were stacked up on either side, feet high. And so Adams begins to read these things, and other Northern congressmen begin to read these things. And you know, you have Nat Turner's rebellion, you have these slave revolts, Nat Turner's rebellion. And, you know, Southern politicians are starting to get a little sick and tired of hearing slavery, you know, their peculiar institution being trashed on the floor of the house, the people's house. House of Representatives, and you're just like talking down to my lifestyle and my labor force. And you know, you're starting to really, they started to really get kind of sick of it, especially the guys from South Carolina, guys like John Henry Hammond and Pinckney, and in the Senate you had John C. Calhoun.
And there's arguments. I mean, there's hypocrisy to some extent, or they'll make sure. That case, because the North is getting cotton from them.
Sure.
The North is getting materials, molasses. They're getting other things from them.
And the North is, they're making the slave clothes, and they're making the implements of the farming tools. So, yeah, sure.
The city of Newark, New Jersey, its major steel customers. We're all South.
And Adams calls us out. He calls us out. He calls us out on the floor. But something happens where a congressman, you know, reads a petition, and then Hammond, John Henry Hammond from South Carolina, says, hey, I move to table this petition. And that means just kind of like, he says, I move that we table them all before we read them. We don't print them. We don't read them out loud. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about them. These petitions come and they're just basically what Adams will say is they go to the vault of the Capulets. They go off to die. And Adams is like, where he does not agree with abolitionists. They're radicals. That he doesn't agree with their tactics. He doesn't think that he hates slavery. He thinks it's morally reprehensible, but he doesn't really see what Congress can do about it, you know? But when Southern congressmen begin to say, we're not even going to read these things, he says, whoa, you're taking away people's freedom of speech. If the First Amendment says that we have a right to freedom of press, freedom of religion, we have a right to petition our government for a redress of grievances. Now you're messing with the Constitution.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job or your title.
As former corporate executives, we know firsthand that navigating corporate waters is not easy.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
I wish people would be able to understand in this corporate world that talking about things that don't work or identifying problems does not mean you're a problem.
We'll dive deep into what happens behind fancy corporate doors or Zoom backgrounds or whatever.
Are they really performance improvement plans or just a legal tool to get rid of people?
I know a lot of people have been saved because of them.
We've created the show to help you navigate tricky corporate situations based on research and real life experience.
I have really good advice. Don't go to a strip club with your team.
Listen to the Ambie Award nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know, You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
No, 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 no. And this is where he gets involved in the fight. And this is what precipitates the passing of the gag rule. And once the gag rule is enacted, where you can't mention slavery on the floor of the House of Representatives from 1836 to 1842, 43, it's as Bruce, as we said in our generation, we would say it's on like Donkey Kong. And this makes Adams an activist. And that is the story that we tell in Founding Son.
Awesome. I love it. And I think that, you know, he's, I know a book that you like. I have it right here, Mr. Sean Wilentz.
Oh,
this is, by the way, Rise of American Democracy.
Yes, mine is sitting in the living room in my reading chair.
I call Rise of the American Democracy one of the founding books of my history can beat up your politics. It was like one of my original go-to, along with John Weil, who is or was a professor at Middle State, along with Ben Sawyer there, constitutional professor, and Stanley Belkins, a couple of little Gordon Wood. And those were my go-to to get the podcast started. His book is so rich that I know that it was a sore. Actually, he did speak on your podcast.
He is one of the experts in this series, the 6-episode series, Founding Son. And he, for me, is the Bob Dylan of historians. And I got to tell him that. And, he's written about Bob. He's actually written a book about Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Rich, 92 verse songs. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, that the Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. I am currently working on what I hope will be a sequel to Founding Son. And I'm back in Rise of American Democracy because it's the well. I told someone yesterday, I'm like, this is the book you need to read because it is the well for this period of history. And I just keep going back to the well, and mine, like yours, is tattered and dog-eared and, you know, just kind of barely holding it together. It is just a sensational book. I tell everyone it is the best book. And, you know, a credit to his, a lot of historians don't have this. Can you write? You can research.
Right.
But can you engage a reader with your writing? And can you bring that time alive? And that's what a skill that Willens has.
I mean, it should be. If you know, we live in a political time. Sometimes we pull our hair out. Sometimes we hate it. We all have our politics. There's people listening to my show that want to see Trump again. There's people listening to my show that want to see Biden again. There's people shaking their head as why these are the two choices and they want someone else. There's all kinds of politics. We should, at least the positive of all of this is we know that politics is always a scene in motion in American history. To think that there's just like two choices and this and no, there's all of these groups and burn, you know, Huskers and
New York State politics in the 19th century, man, the Locofocos against the barn burners. Yeah. Oh man. And that's Wilentz's wheelhouse.
Yeah.
That, you know, those groups. And so he really gets into all that stuff. But man, he really brings it alive. Bruce, that book taught me, that was when I had the thought of the good, the bad, the ugly of American history.
It's not, you know? All, I mean, they're not all good. I mean, some of the people opposing I can plug again that I'm working on.
Please.
Usually Willens.
Hey, it's
book.
Your show. Please.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Hey, Bruce,
I keep forgetting.
Bruce, what are you working on these days? Tell us about it.
There you go. I love having a podcaster on because you can just reverse roll. I am working on a Zachary Taylor. It's going to be Zachary is Ready, at least a 3-parter. And it is going to be a narrative-ish history of these times, but a little later. And Sean Wilentz, definitely that book, definitely one of many sources. It's a good starting point. You read something and then you're like, oh, what's that? Let me get more into it.
Yes.
And
layers, right? These things, when we put these things together, these are layers. We're layering.
Well, I will admit, when I first started my history of computer politics, it used to be I would just tell a story and it would be this happened and then that happened. And something like looking at the notes of Sean Wilentz and rereading and going into journal, that didn't, I would, you know, until we get to about the time I appeared on you guys' show in 2016, that started getting more complex, richer, a little bit more pulling things out, just because, you know, you're finding that there are these complexities. And just because one person, one historian says something, that doesn't mean it's necessarily true. There's always,
right,
in all our communications, there's fact and interpretation mixed together.
God, what was I reading about the other day? And like, okay, Dred Scott, when Buchanan's inaugurated, he goes up to Taney is Roger B. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Taney, and he's about to administer the oath to James Buchanan. And there's this Supreme Court case that is pending. The nation is on pins and needles waiting for the results. And some say there's the two men are seen having a conversation before Buchanan takes the oath. And then I think in the speech, Buchanan kind of references the Dred Scott and what's about, well, I think something's going to happen and it's going to fix the slavery thing. You know, Zachary Taylor, the Compromise of 1850, you know, it's another like, okay, Missouri Compromise. I think we fixed the slavery thing. I think we're good now. And then Compromise of 1850 is like, you know what? This is the one that's going to fix it all. Dred Scott, 1857. It's like, well, this Supreme Court, they're going to rule on this and it's just going to, we're going to be good after that, you know, and each compromise makes things worse.
It certainly makes things worse.
And anyway,
The whole Taney and Buchanan thing, we still don't know. That shows up in the Lincoln Douglas debates where Douglas is like, you're a stupid conspiracy. Well, he doesn't say it this way. You're a stupid conspiracy monger but certainly don't involve me in the conspiracy. Douglas says,
right. Wilentz says that, Buchanan knew he had been in contact, not just with Taney, but with another Supreme Court justice from Pennsylvania, from his home state, Greer, named Greer. And Buchanan was in on the whole decision, and the court didn't have to, and this is so echoing of our time right now. You have these Supreme Court's decisions and they don't need to be so narrow, but then they write a broad decision that changes a policy in the direction of the country. Same thing happens here. And there's conspiracy theories about, you know, politicians being involved in the Supreme Court's decision and the Supreme Court making this decision for political purposes, which they did. But then if you read different historical accounts and Alan Nevins and Sean Wilentz, and there's another one I'm reading, McPherson, Battle Cry of Freedom. You get like, you know, slightly, or then maybe you read a biographer of, say, William Henry Seward, because Seward will call this out in a speech himself after the decision's read. And you realize, you know what Seward calls for? Reforming the court.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things, we just kind of we see them happening over and over again in American history, and different historians pull out different aspects. They highlight different aspects of these complex, you know, issues. These things, they play out like in our politics. You know, one day, DeSantis is. Let's get off DeSantis metaphors here, but like, politics happens minute by minute, day by day. And then 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, people write books about these things that played out slowly over long periods of time. And so different historians highlight different moments in the controversy, for sure.
Oh, the summaries, and they make it so easy. I'm waiting for the 2012. It'll be like, Obama coasted to election. Does anybody realize how scared those that campaign was, that there was came so close to Romney winning, even though in the end it didn't. But the way history is written is so far back and all of this stuff, I am waiting to see George W. Bush in history. I believe with some time, it'll be a lot less favorable. I am waiting. You know, he may feel differently, but I see that coming. Right now, he's coming in the middle of presidential ranking. But
hey, Bruce, speaking of Obama and Romney.
Yeah.
How about this debate with Candy Crowley where Romney says Russia is our biggest adversary right now. And Obama says, hey, Mitt, the 1980s called. They want their foreign policy back.
Yeah, listen, I mean, Obama made a lot of errors and mistakes. I often think, you know, while he's an amazing political and celebrity figure, you know, I think Nancy Pelosi did some of the lifting in the beginning and
absolutely,
you know, there's all of this stuff going on there. But yeah, I don't think, you know, what a great prophecy there. And Romney really did well in that first debate. But on topic, though, I'm reminded of this. I had Sidney Blumenthal on. And one of the things he said that really jogged me about this time period and getting into John Quincy Adams' presidency and post-presidency period is you have to remember, Bruce, he said, we were one country. So you had the slave South and the North and the West, whatever it was going to be, the fighting out over there. We were one country, which means you couldn't, you know, it's all well and good to talk about the 14th and 15th Amendment, getting them passed, about all this kind of, at that time, progressive, say, legislation getting passed when states couldn't vote, couldn't block anything because they weren't let back into the Union yet, or their governments had been so destroyed, they had a different set of politics. But at that time, these people are still in South Carolina with its slave, slave power government, say, is in the Union. It's part of the decision making. You can't separate. They're going to get into the federal government. If anything, South had a little edge until you get the run up to the Civil War. And so, yeah, there's all of these kind of politics. Sidney Blumenthal and Sean Willans do a really good job. Blumenthal wrote a bunch of Abraham Lincoln books. They do a really good job of showing how carefully, like a figure like Douglas is balancing, like, even though people like Lincoln dislike him, some people feel like he's great because he's taking on Buchanan at times. And Jefferson Davis doesn't, he's having a lot of trouble getting the nomination from Southerners and Democrats. So just this balancing act. And I think that's the thing to think about when John Quincy Adams comes with all his New England states voting for him. He got more states in that election, but he's crippled because of this kind of politics.
Bruce, it's so hard for me to stay out of these rabbit holes. Can I make one Douglas comment before we go back to Adams?
Sure, absolutely.
So Douglas, he starts all this with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, absolutely. Right? The guy rips the country apart. And then a couple of years later, when the pro-slavery Lecompton, you know, convention puts forth this constitution that's completely bunk, and this is a lot of backstory here that I guess this might be just for Bruce and I and all of you out there who've studied Kansas-Nebraska. But then, you know, when the Kansas is about to pass this bunk constitution to join the Union as a pro-slavery state, Douglas is like, whoa, no, I don't support this at all. I don't support this at all. The popular sovereignty has not been used here.
Yeah.
So anyway,
not appropriately, because it wasn't appropriate. No. Yeah, I mean, but you see in the, I think how it relates, if is it's one of those band-aids, at least in his mind, it's one of his whole popular sovereignty, which goes all the way back to Lewis Cass and other democratic schemes in the West. This is how we'll solve it. We'll just have the squatters vote. well, you know, that only that doesn't work when there's a one group can get together and say, this is our, we voted and we, you know, it's hard policing those elections, essentially. It's just one of many band-aids during this time to right. try to solve this issue in a myriad complexity of ways. I mean, you take someone like a Calhoun who's operating during this time. He don't want to solve the issue. He's no. like, the best thing that can happen is we get out of this union, we get our independence, that's and we right. don't have to pay a price for it, you know? And whereas other people desperately, you know, a Rufus King, say, William Rufus King, they want to solve these issues, you know, even though he's from Alabama, they want Henry Clay, we want to solve these issues. You have in the North, I suppose, Webster, although he's a mix.
He's a mix. He's so when I started reading about American history, he was one of these beloved figures.
Mm-hmm.
The more mm-hmm. I read about him, I don't see him that way. You know, I can get us back to Adams. Adams kept a journal from 1779 mm-hmm. until 1848.
Mm-hmm.
Adams, and I'm going to just say that again, just for emphasis. Adams kept a journal from 1779 to 1848. This journal, which was written in most days, if he was going through some depressive periods in his life, he didn't write when he was very depressed, but he wrote mostly every day in that period and through those years. And that diary is become a resource for historians of the period. It is a pretty reliable resource, but also it's where Adams said what he really thought. And he would write about Webster, mm-hmm. you know, and Clay and Calhoun. Mm-hmm. And just, he saw through their statements he saw their true ambitions. And Webster was one of these guys who was, it was a blowhard. He was eloquent. But it was more show than tell, I guess, is what Adams would kind of think of him. He was more of a, more worried about his image and more of a self promoter than someone who really cared about being a public servant, which is what Adams was at to his core. Adams, I believe, was one of our nation's greatest public servants.
If we take it, he does decide, he turns a bit when he's in Congress to, and I guess this is another complexity of politics at this time that we always have to think about. You keep hearing this term, the slave power. And so Lincoln uses it. He uses other terms as well, but he uses it. Thomas Hart Benton would use something like this. Like, even people who own slaves are using right. the term the slave power, because they may own some slaves on their plantation, but they don't feel part of the slave power. And someone like a Webster might here or there attack the slave power or other speakers in New England, particularly, not necessarily being anti-slavery.
No.
But against a system that's growing, that's taking power, that's reducing the power of the free worker. And so you could kind of run this balance. And it appears like Adams did this a little bit, like he was speaking out against a slave power. You know,
Adams called them the slaveocracy.
Slaveocracy.
That was right. his term for it. And yes, so once the gag rules passed in 1836, and this is actually when Texas becomes a republic, like the same week, mm-hmm. you know, within a few days of the gag rule being passed, Texas becomes a republic. And so now you can't talk about slavery on the floor of the House of Representatives, but you can talk about Texas. And what's at the root of the debate over annexing Texas but slavery? And yeah. so Adams knew every rule of order in Congress, every rule in Congress. Adams was an expert. So what he does is, and we chronicle this in this series, I call it political jujitsu. He would use the rules of the House in order to interject his disdain of slavery and fight about the gag rule. He would just, if they were, whatever they were debating, Adams was so well read, so deeply researched, so adept at the rules of order that he could manipulate the situation and the conversation to make other Southern politicians say things they didn't want to say. He could get them riled up and fired up. And sometimes he would be giving a speech and he would taunt Southerners, and then they would be going off and kind of like showing their hiney on the floor. And he would sit down and he would laugh. He'd just be laughing because he completely manipulated the situation to his own will. He would play them like a fiddle, as we like to say. He played the slaveocracy like a fiddle in Congress.
And I think, you know, obviously the whole battle's over expansion, because absent that expansion, if things stayed the same, you see the North gaining more power and as they would eventually do, taking over. But figuring out, you know, how to knock out some of the entrenchments and taking over more. So expansion's the goal. But I think that's the key moment of Adams, is in terms of his fight against the slave power and the gag rule. And again, absent that,
agreed,
he'd be kind of mediocre president, former, you know, treaty with Spain, that's cool and everything, but you know, we got Florida, cool, you know, pretty good. DeSantis owes him a favor, speaking of DeSantis, but put that aside. Wouldn't be much to say, but it's this fight that really makes him an American character. And I know on your podcast, there's a lot more to get into about
the
Amistad and everything else, but where do you think you want to go from here?
Well, 1850s. Mm-hmm. And I have been studying William Henry Seward a lot. And I feel like he's a mentor. He's a mentee. Mm-hmm. Adams was his mentor. He's close with Charles Francis Adams. Mm-hmm. Adams's son, who will play a role. And, you know, Seward is a guy like who, you know, this period of history, it's like, we need the people that lived it to tell us the story of the times. And Adams was such a great vehicle to tell the story. He was a great, I like to say, tour guide, mm-hmm, of the 1830s and 1840s. And I think Seward is that guy for the 1850s. And then he becomes Lincoln's Secretary of State. But, you know, it was his nomination to lose in 1860. And there is a great, I'll call it a scene that I've read and looking from researching it from Charles Francis Adams' side and from Seward's side, is like, you know, maybe this is a tease for the future, I hope. But when Seward loses the Republican nomination to Abraham Lincoln on the third, was it the third ballot? I don't remember what it was, but
sounds right.
But when he loses the nomination, he's at home in his garden in Auburn, New York, when he gets the word, and he says, you know, it's time for retirement. It's okay. It's okay. He wasn't upset. He didn't show it. He was maybe relieved. You know, he'd been in politics for decades. He was governor of New York for two terms, senator of New York. And, you know, he'd seen, like we say of Adams, he'd seen a lot of winters. And it was okay. But John Quincy Adams' son, who says, you need to go campaign for this guy, Lincoln. You need to go out and give speeches. We need to get him elected. He needs to be elected. This country needs him. And so Adams and Seward and one of Adams, Charles Francis Adams' sons, go on this Western tour. They go all the way out to like Wisconsin at the time. And so this is 1860. And they give, I think Seward gives like 95 speeches,
mm-hmm,
on Lincoln's behalf and helps get him elected. And then, of course, he'll play this incredible role in Lincoln's administration. And really, he keeps Britain and France out of the Civil War.
I think it's a great choice. I think he just picked a great moment. It's funny. I remember talking about that in our 1860 cast in 2020 that we did, and we talked about that moment where he hurls himself into the campaign, and so important in beating Stephen Douglas in the 1860 election and reducing Stephen Douglas, who was a threat still in Illinois and other places. to have that Western tour and have this enthusiastic, also beating back a possible abolitionist challenge, because Seward takes on some of those forces on Lincoln's left, if you will. So really important moment. That's going to be a great one. I think you're picking them right. I'll take care of Zachary Taylor if you take William Seward. All right.
Deal. Done and done.
Bob, anything else that you want to highlight? Where can people find you? All that good stuff.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, I'm on the social media thing. I'm at Bob Crawford Base. If you want to find me on the Devil's Playground.
What's it called this week? I don't even remember.
I don't even know. It's disgusting. But more importantly, The Road to Now, the podcast is, you can get it wherever you get your podcasts, as they say. And then we're on SiriusXM POTUS channel on weekends. That's channel 124. And we are on throughout the weekend. They play it like four or five times throughout the weekend. So check us out, The Road to Now. And we crank them out. You know, we put a lot of re-airs up this past summer.
Everybody does.
But we're back at it. And we've got some. Bruce, have you? I'm excited. And this is like, we haven't even recorded it yet. But have you seen this book yet coming out?
Let's see. Gallop Towards the Sun. I have not.
Yes, I'm so. I have to read this by Wednesday. So we're going to talk to Peter Stark next Wednesday. Oh, and this week I recorded yesterday an episode with Robert O'Hara Jr., formerly of the Washington Post, investigative journalist, who wrote a book about Montgomery Meigs. And the book's been out since 2016, but I just met Robert recently. We've become friends, and again, that's this time period, like Meigs, he's in charge of the Capitol, the renovation of the Capitol in the 1850s. The backdrop is the time period we've been discussing.
Wow.
And Meigs becomes Lincoln's quartermaster. That will come out on Monday, and then we'll interview Peter Stark next week, his book about William Henry Harrison and Tecumseh. And on we go, Bruce.
Exciting stuff. Everybody check out Bob Crawford and his podcast, Founding Son. Got to check it out. You should have already. So I'm going to, but I'll give you another chance. And then if you don't, you're a bad listener. And bad listener. And also The Road to Now with Bob and Ben. Bob, good to see an old friend. Thanks for coming on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.
Oh, Bruce, I wish you and I could be at Louis playing the jukebox and drinking a beer, but those things don't exist anymore. So
I think it turned into a condo or breakfast or something.
I think it did. It's so great to see you, my friend, always.
All right. Same here.
Thank you.
And we really want to thank Bob Crawford for coming on. Check out his podcast, Founding Son. Check out The Road to Now. Check out the Avett Brothers, all of that good stuff. Thanks, Bob. And thank you for listening.